Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 204, a quick whip around the globe in 1855, and Cetshwayo Khampande makes his regal entrance. First up, a quick thank you to Adi Badenhorst at A.A. Badenhorst Family Wines in the Swartland of the Cape. Your gift was extraordinarily generous and well received. I'm truly indebted to you and to all those folks sending me tips and notes. Thank you. It's gratifying to receive correspondence from such learned folks. Straight to our episode 204. Planet Earth, 1855. Cetshwayo Khampande grows powerful and Natal land realities. A legend is the only way to describe the AmaZulu king who was going to dethrone his father, Mpandika Senzangakhona, usurp his brother's right to rule, and later in life destroy an entire British column at Isandlwana. In this episode, we'll deal with the initial years of his life. People tend to focus on Shaka when it comes to important Zulu warriors, but by the time we're done, you'll probably agree that Cetshwayo was more significant. I'll end the editorializing right there, so let's head over to the eastern seaboard of South Africa, into Zululand across the Tugela River. 1855. King Mpande had overthrown his half-brother Dingane, and one of his professed goals was to stop the internecine conflict that had riven the house of the Zulu. Peace is what he strived for, and so he set about creating sons unlike Shaka and Dingane, who had their offspring killed, or tried to insure themselves against being bumped off by just not getting their wives or concubines pregnant. Easier said than done. Mpande had at least 30 sons with his wives, believing that his protection lay in numbers. Problem was, there would always be someone who thinks they're better than the eldest son of the great wife, and the eldest son of the great wife will always believe he should be king. Fade up the ominous music. And thus, in a nutshell, Cetshwayo. By the mid-1850s, Mpande was beginning to realize the folly of having so many children, because quite a few of the senior male kids now began to calculate that they were in with a chance for the crown. The Boers were going to feature in this upcoming civil war, so too the British. Some Boers fought on Cetshwayo's side, while British traders and white hunters fought on the side of Mbuyazi, including John Dunn, who is an epic man of the 19th century. There were Boers amongst the Amabuto who fought at the Battle of Ndondokasuka Mountain near the Tugela River, a battle that was going to decide the future of the Zulu nation. Cetshwayo was born in 1832, we believe, at Mpande's Lambongwenya homestead in southeastern Zululand. His mother was Nkumbazi of the Zungu royal line. Some say he was born in 1833. We're not entirely sure of the year. But we do know that Shaka paid the Ilobolo for Nkumbazi on Mpande's account. This made her the great wife. It also meant that Cetshwayo was Senzangakhona's grandson. He was both a child of status and a child in great peril. He was raised like all other Zulu boys and taken along with Mpande to meet the Boers in 1839, when Mpande negotiated a future without Dingane with the Trekkers, further cementing the succession narrative. Once Mpande was made king in 1840, Cetshwayo was formally known as an Mtwana, a child of the king, a prince. At 18, Cetshwayo was recruited into the Utulwana Ubuto, or regiment, and that was in 1850 or 1851. There were seven other princes in this regiment in the same age grade. A year later, they were fighting in the Swazi campaign, sharpening their tactical and strategic skills, also sussing each other out on the field of battle, and Cetshwayo was a great warrior. He had a mentor, an older man, an Isikhulu, Nyamana Kankrengelele. His mentor was one of Mpande's favorite advisors, rich in cattle, a tall man with a pointy beard, which was unusual in Zulu culture of the time. When Nyamana spoke, his voice was deep and people listened. Cetshwayo enjoyed his company and learned a great deal from him, for the mentor was an astute politician and cool under pressure. By the time of Mpande's installation as king, Cetshwayo had grown into a big barrel-chested man with the thick hairy legs of all of Senzangakhona's bloodline. Also darker in complexion than most Zulu, he still flushed deeply when angry and had followed Shaka's fitness regime, walking up to 10 kilometers a day. His natural posture was chest out, head back. A man who surveyed inferiors. That didn't mean he was rude, more regal, highly courteous, quite genial, convivial even. Cetshwayo loved a good story and witty repartee, and gossip was his favourite pastime. This got him in some trouble over the years. He could also suddenly shut down, go dark, taciturn. Scary. Mpande appeared to favour this lad over the other princes, and Cetshwayo began to consolidate his power base around the area of Nongoma. His mother, Ngumbazi, was made head of the Kwaxhakaza in Kadna, where Dingane had built his last great place, his Ngungudlovu. The northern chiefs were watched closely by Ngumbazi, and in particular the chiefs like Mapita. Others in the area were more dependable, Masipula and Mnyamana, for example. The growing power of Cetshwayo began to worry Mpande. He had groomed this prince to be the likely heir, but now the heir appeared to be getting too big for his boots. Word reached Mpande, after the Swazi campaign of 1852, that Cetshwayo was cementing his ties with the northern chiefs, banking on the day he was to become king. It appeared to Mpande that Cetshwayo thought that day was sooner rather than later. Problem was, Mpande was still king and didn't like that one little bit. When Cetshwayo also schmoozed the Kwa Bazeni people south of Nongoma, and word spread of Cetshwayo's courage during the Swazi campaign, Mpande decided it was time to act. So the Zulu king then altered his story about the infamous visit to the Boers, where he had introduced Cetshwayo as the prince-in-waiting, saying the young boy had been but an ordinary person at the time, not a real prince. This was a bit of a contradiction. Mpande also began dropping thought bombs on his councillors that Mbuyazi should be the preferred heir because Mbuyazi was a much better candidate to take over the top job. The big challenge in succession planning when leaders change their tune is that it creates confusion, anger and internal strife. Whether it's at McKinsey or the Zulu Royal Line or Rupert Murdoch's new will, those named in the old will or named as the likely successor tend to take umbrage. Naturally so. There were other reasons that Mbuyazi was preferred. His mother, Monasi, was Isiqebe or lover of Shaka. And Shaka had taken her from his Isigodlo and donated her to Mpande, giving her in marriage along with a large herd of cattle. This elevated both Monasi and Mbuyazi in the eyes of the royal family. Monasi also had a specially built umuzi for her. The whispering amongst oral historians intimated that Shaka gave Monasi to Mpande because she was already pregnant with Shaka's baby. Some say this was just a vicious campaign to deny Mbuyazi his rightful place as heir to the throne. Another version of why Monasi ended up with Mpande was that Shaka had invoked the custom of ukuvuza, where a man would raise the child of another to avoid the child being killed. You can see how the muddied waters of succession were turning into a torrent of confusion. Mpande made some startling announcements at this time, 1854 and 1855. Mbuyazi, said Mpande, being so like Shaka, moreover tall and athletic, made him a better look for the job. I'm paraphrasing a little, but Mpande did comment on Mbuyazi's athletic build and his height. Very kingly, you know. Mbuyazi also had Senzangakona's hairy lower back and a huge head of hair. Thus, Mpande gave Mbuyazi his praise name, the elephant with a tuft of hair. A number of special events took place, such as the first fruit ceremonies and the installation of new regiments, and at each, Mpande deliberately insulted Cetshwayo. This backfired because the lad had been publicly venerated previously, and the change in attitude shocked the AmaZulu public and the other chiefs. By now, Cetshwayo had managed to secure a large coterie of loyal northern chiefs in his ambit, and their Amabuto were combined into a single army known as the Usutu, which meant with the long horns, and named after the Sutu-type cattle Cetshwayo regiments had captured from the Pedi people and arrayed into the Transvaal in 1851. And so Cetshwayo's men began to shout the battle cry of Usutu, which is precisely what the Zulu army did in 1879 at the Battle of Isandlwana. They also began to distinguish themselves from other Amabuto physically and took to wearing an ornament made of the end of a cow's tail worn erect on the crown of the head, a plume. While all this mobilizing and prepping was going on, Mbuyazi was not idle. He combined his own groups of Induna and Ubuto at his mother's home in Tengweni, and his faction was called the Isikoza. The meaning is symbolic. Isikoza means to drop down like the drops of water from a roof. His support base was trickling in. Their regalia included a flap of cowskin over their ears and an oxtail in the center of the forehead. Their battle cry was a little less visceral, "Laba, laba, laba, bayozi basiboni," or "Those people are really going to see who we are." Not only was the war cry a bit tame, but the trickling water bit was a problem, because there was a flood going on when it came to Usutu numbers. Mpandi was alarmed when he realized that Mbuyazi's Isixhosa were being outmatched and outnumbered by Cetshwayo's Usutu. Mpandi's solution was divide and rule. In a manner, he thought he'd insert himself between the two princes, separating them. Segregation, an old South African trick. Mbuyazi was moved north to the other side of the White Umfolozi, right in the heart of Cetshwayo territory. Cetshwayo was moved south to the Umhlathuzi River on the southern bank. His new homestead will be called Undini, somewhere between my home place of Nkweleni and the port of Richards Bay. Cetshwayo's ally in the north, Chief Masipula, had a fit. He seethed at this insertion. Mpandi's actions had backfired once more. Now supporters of the two princes became even more polarized. Then a game hunt was going to further concentrate the minds, because Mbuyazi and Cetshwayo both asked for permission to hold a joint hunt. I mean, what could go wrong? Two different wannabe chiefs arming their regiments for a hunt together when everyone knew they really wanted to pin each other. Forget the Nyamaza. It was a mock hunt, because both sets of Amabutu carried their war shields to this hunt, not their hunting shields. This was going to be a duel in the bush between the Usutu and the Isixhosa. Except it wasn't, because the Isixhosa melted away from the so-called hunt before it began, a rather inauspicious result for Mbuyazi. This was a festering sore on the Zulu royal succession limb. Eventually, it would lead to one of the most brutal battles in Zulu history, which took place at the end of December 1856. We'll come back to that battle in a future podcast. While Mpandi plotted, Cetshwayo planned, and Mbuyazi hesitated, down south, land was being snapped up across Natal. The settler port village of Durban had gone through various ructions by the mid-1850s. For some distance around the port and into the interior, English settlers had replaced the original Dutch farmers, with the stipulation that a farmer could own only one farm of 2,500 acres and security of tenure had improved slightly. Originally, tenure was a measly 15 years, then changed to perpetuity. Marking out the farms was done on horseback at walking pace, 1 hour each way, 4 hours. That was your farm. Most mustered the fastest horse they could find. Some even changed horses, then galloped or cantered the 4 hours. Land sizes could top 5,000 acres by cheating in this way. Simultaneously, a clash of ideas between the indigenous population of South Africa and the British government became the most marked in Natal. It's all about the landscape. Most of the region is suitable for farming in some manner. The region can be divided pretty broadly into two zones, the interior grasslands and open tree savanna, and the coastal bush and forest. The grasslands were not all ideal for arable agriculture, but great for livestock farming. The coastal zone was a different story. More rain fell along the coast. It was more suitable for farming, and that's why sugar became such an important story in Natal a little later. It also became clear to the British administrators that because of the differences in types of vegetation, farms of uniform size were unsuitable. North and west of the Bushman's River, farmers could own 3,400 acres for their cattle, sheep and goats. Closer to the coast, though, the size dropped to 1,250 acres and smaller. Furthermore, the coastal land was much more expensive to buy. 4 shillings per acre instead of one. 4 shillings was 40 cents. In a kind of blatant, tone-deaf approach to history, the British government, reports of the time, spoke glowingly of the fantastic land ready for immigrants from England. You'd think they would have learned from the 1820 settler experience, but no, apparently not. This increase in immigration duly took place in Natal between 1849 and 1851. In those 2 years, 5,000 British immigrants immigrated to a series of settlements throughout the territory south of the Tugela River. Many left as soon as they arrived. The Colonial Land and Emigration Commissioners then warned that Natal does not appear to hold forth any very great opening for general agricultural purposes. Markets for these new farmers lay in distant towns. Natal lacked roads and railways to transport these goods, and towns were small and could meet their own meat and vegetable and fruit needs. Many trekkers remained on their farms inland. There was no opportunity to find pastures. Even more ironically, the Trekkers had not paid for this land, but the English immigrants were expected to cough up between 1 and 4 shillings per acre. Trekker farms were huge, 4,000 acres or more, whereas the English immigrants closer to towns often ended up on plots of only 60 acres or even less. There was a dichotomy of farm size which shaped the future settlement of Natal. The British were endeavouring to create an English village community and fostered this by providing towns and commonages for each settlement. The plots were all within walking distance of the town, so everyone could make their way to the local church, market, the schools, the shops. No horse required. This was in complete contrast to the Trekker settlements, which were far more scattered. You couldn't reach a town in a day on a horse, let alone walk to the church. The urban Englishman class had arrived in Natal, and within a few years the colony would change completely. It would also propel the region into a war that pitted the English against the Zulu, and land was the main reason. Meanwhile, in the Transvaal, land was the aim, and the new Volksraads had settled into place in the mid-1850s. All Africans living within this region were now regarded as under Trekker jurisdiction. Land here was given to the original Voortrekkers on a very generous basis, no money required, for free. 2 6,000-acre farms were given to each Trekker as a right, including Paul Kruger, who at the time was 16, and received 2 of these 6,000-acre farms. One was for grazing, the other for growing crops. From this time onwards, title holders such as veldkornets and commandants were able to acquire substantial land holdings. They were the officials who had inside information about the workings of the land market and took full advantage of this knowledge. It was during this time that officials in the Transvaal were paid in land rather than in cash because of the chronic money shortage experienced by the Trekkers. As the white population grew, the pressure to find new land grew exponentially. With that, it's time to step back and peer inscrutably and quickly at what was going on internationally in the year 1855. The Panama Railway became the first railroad to connect the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, long before the time of the canal, which was built between 1904 and 1916. In 1855, Alexander II ascended the Russian throne. In China, the Taiping Rebellion rolled on. The Taiping army of 350,000 invaded Anhui in the east of that country. Van Diemen's Land was separated from New South Wales and granted self-government, and later in that year renamed Tasmania. For the wine connoisseurs listening, including Adi Barnhorst, I hope, the Bordeaux wine classification system was first listed in 1855. A group of American mercenaries under William Walker, known as the Filibusters, sailed from San Francisco to Central America in an attempt to conquer Nicaragua. The stamp revenue tax was removed from British newspapers, which meant for the first time there was free mass media in the United Kingdom. The Kansas legislature met and began passing laws in favor of slavery, pushing America ever closer to their horrendous civil war. Walt Whitman's first poetry was published in the U.S. in 1855. David Livingstone became the first European to visit the Victoria Falls, setting off a massive tourism boom which still makes money off gawking Europeans spending euros at the Morsuwa Tunya, the smoke that thunders. In the Middle East, the Ulema of Mecca in Saudi Arabia triggered a war over slavery which he openly supported, calling Western attempts at banning slavery un-Islamic. The Hejaz Rebellion against the Ottoman Empire began shortly afterwards. Lastly, the first cocaine alkaloid was isolated by the German chemist Friedrich Goethe, and when sampling his terrible product, he described the alkaloid as being of small crystal molecules with needle-like points on 4 to 6 sides, which resulted in a numbing effect on a small tongue test. What began as a scientific curiosity has since spiraled into a deadly global scourge, a pattern echoed by other 19th century innovations, from dynamite to industrial chemicals, where progress came with unforeseen destruction. With that happy thought, it's time to end. Next episode, we'll continue the story of Cetshwayo's emergence and hear more about the Pedi people and their trials and tribulations pummeled by both the Zulu and the Boers. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can also email me from there. Sorry about the background noise. There are children playing at my neighbor's house. Until next, Salagatli.